You are tuned into The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening to the radio. Now, if you read a newspaper, not just in Seattle, but across this state, there's a good chance you've seen something about Senate Bill 6617. Newspapers across Washington ran front page editorials this week urging Governor Inslee to veto 6617, and the phones in the state capitol are ringing.
Governor's office, this is Sheila.
All right, I will pass that on.
Governor's appreciate your call, ma'am.
Sheila,
bye-bye.
Calling regarding Senate Bill 6617?
Good morning, Governor's office. Are you calling regarding Senate Bill 6617?
Okay, are you wanting him to veto that, sir? Thank you. Quickly, what's your other
for comment? Public records?
That's right. A lot of public input on public records. And here to explain what's going on is KOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Welcome, Austin.
Thanks for having me. I want to be clear, that tape that you just heard, that was not edited or cut up in any way. It was nonstop.
That was
while I was in there.
Multiple people talking over each other because they're all grabbing phones.
They're grabbing phones as fast as they can. They've got tallying marks on a piece of paper. And they had two people doing that when I was there. I think at times they've had three. And they said it was slower today than it was yesterday.
This began, Austin, with a disagreement over whether state lawmakers are covered by public disclosure laws. Why would we be disagreeing about that?
Well, let's just back up and remind listeners that last September, a coalition of news outlets, including public radio, filed an open records lawsuit against Washington's legislative leaders. And that lawsuit sought access to lawmaker emails, calendars, text messages, and other records that had been denied to reporters. By the way, this is information that if you request from your city council member or other local elected officials, you could get under the state's robust voter-approved Public Records Act. But Washington lawmakers had cited a 1995 definition of legislative records and said that they were exempt from disclosing. So the media files a lawsuit. In January, the media won a partial victory in that lawsuit. In that ruling, the Thurston County judge found that lawmaker records are subject to the state's public disclosure law. That's number one. So they fall under that state law. And secondly, that individual state representatives and senators are agencies as defined by the Public Records Act. And that would mean that their records, such as calendars and emails, are subject to disclosure.
Okay. Now, sometimes, as we've been saying this week, judges' decisions get overturned. And enough lawmakers, disagree with that ruling that the legislature has passed this bill, Senate Bill 6617. And what does it do?
Right. So first off, in that lawsuit, there's an appeal that is going on. The state appealed.
Right.
And trying to get the Supreme Court to review it. So while that's going on, let's think of this as a game of rock, paper, scissors. Okay.
Okay.
So you've got the judge who comes in and issues this ruling and says, you know, nope, your records are subject to the Public Disclosure Act. And that's the rock. Mm-hmm. Now the legislature comes along with a piece of paper called a bill. It says, you know, we're going to cover that rock.
Yes, that's the paper.
Paper.
Covering the Public Disclosure Act stone, the rock.
Yes. Uh-huh. And what this bill does is it exempts the legislature from the voter-approved Public Records Act. Like, there's no hiding about that. They're not even pretending that's not the case. Mm-hmm. It exempts the legislature, and it sets up a new statute, a new law, that dictates what records are subject to release and which records are not. So it says final disciplinary proceedings against a legislator would be subject to disclosure under this new law. Legislative calendars, subject to disclosure. Legislative communications with lobbyists, but not with constituents, even if that constituent is a major campaign donor, subject to disclosure. So communications with lobbyists, yes, they get disclosed. Communications with constituents, no, they don't get disclosed under this law. These records would be subject to disclosure starting in July. All previous records that have been requested by the media and members of the public, not subject to disclosure. So there's a retroactive element to this where they exempt themselves from the Public Records Act retroactively as well as into the future. There's no judicial review if they say no to a release of a record based on a request. You can't go to the courts as you can under the Public Records Act. This bill has an emergency clause, so it goes into effect immediately upon the governor's signature, and that also means the public cannot referendum the law and try to get it overturned. So those are the general elements of this.
So that's the legislative paper covering the judicial rock, and what are the scissors?
So the scissors would be the governor.
Uh-huh.
He can step in, and maybe we should get to that, because, you know, that's sort of the next step in this, but you know, it's gotten very contentious, as evidenced by the governor's phone blowing up, evidenced by those front page editorials in papers across the state, the first front page editorial in the Seattle Times, I think, in over 100 years. Lawmakers are feeling some heat on this. In fact, the Sunshine, of all days, this or all weeks, the Sunshine Committee, which looks at the Public Records Act and the exemptions, met yesterday here in Olympia. There are four members of the legislature, I believe, who are on this committee. All but one were absent. Representative Larry Springer, a Democrat, showed up, and here's what, and this topic came up. And in fact, they ended up passing a resolution urging the governor to veto this bill. But here's what Representative Larry Springer said about the process that led to this bill getting passed last week.
I've let the governor's legislative affairs director know in no uncertain terms that the process we used, quite frankly, I think the word I use is that it sucked. That was me speaking for Larry, not for my caucus and not for the legislature.
So we should explain what he thinks sucked about the process.
Okay, what does he think sucked about the process?
So this bill, 6617, came out last Wednesday. After all of the policy bill cutoffs, like we had left, the trains had left the station and delivered policy bills onto the floor of the legislature. They'd been passed. We were kind of into the budget phase of a short 60-day session. This bill appears out of nowhere. It gets a work session the following day with some public comment, but it's not a formal public comment or formal public hearing. So that would be Thursday. Friday, the bill passes off the floors of the House and the Senate. Within about half an hour, probably less, time. It moved so quickly between chambers that reporters in one chamber didn't have time to get over to the other chamber before it was already under debate. Two people in each chamber stood up to support this bill. Nobody stood up to oppose it. And in both chambers, it passed with better than supermajority votes.
Okay, supermajorities and above. So what is it that these legislators who signed this bill, why do they think it is so important for the legislature to be exempt from the Public Records Act?
So they're saying that this court ruling back in January did two things. One, that the judge actually invited them to pass a law. In his wording, in his ruling, they're saying he invited us to address this through legislative action. Secondly, they're saying that they don't have a formal process for fulfilling public disclosure requests and that they needed to create one. They are also saying that they thought that they were operating under a certain set of rules all along, and now that there's some ambiguity about that, they want to make clear what the rules are going forward. That's what they are saying. They're also saying that they are bringing new transparency to the legislative process that didn't exist before. And let's listen to what State Representative Matt Shea, a Republican from the Spokane Valley, said. He was one of the two people in the House to stand up and speak in favor of this bill when it was on the floor of the House last week. Here's what he said.
This bill, very simply to me, is going to expand and reveal lobbyist communications, which is something I think we all agree with. And currently, that is not disclosable. We are expanding transparency today.
So legislators say they're expanding transparency. Why do so many journalists keep saying that's not true? Right.
And I'll note that Representative Shea is an attorney. So he's standing there as a lawmaker, but he's got a knowledgeable legal mind. Mm-hmm. He said that those records are not subject to disclosure. I think that is a matter of debate because, in fact, a judge just last month ruled that, in fact, legislators are subject to the Public Disclosure Act and that their communications are subject to disclosure. Now, he hasn't ruled on the specific, you know, we have pending requests, reporters do. He hasn't ruled on the specific requests and the specific documents, but he has said that these communications are subject to disclosure. So I think that there you can debate that point. It's true that there is nothing in current law today that explicitly says what is subject to disclosure, and this bill would do that. And it's also true that I think there is keen interest on the part of reporters and the public in what's going on between lobbyists and lawmakers in Olympia and the communications and the influence. So in that sense, explicitly making those available would represent a difference. But again, a constituent email or communication would be privileged. And that would be true whether the constituent is talking about being a whistleblower to some sort of government corruption, which is an issue that lawmakers say they need to protect that constituent, or if it's a big-time campaign donor asking for some help on a personal project. That would be privileged and protected too under this. So what the media has been, and really this is the editorial pages of the newspapers, members of the Sunshine Committee yesterday are saying that the process was a problem because this was not a crowdsourced bill. There was not a stakeholder process. It was rushed through without, you know, so they're complaining about the process. There's also this concern that it's retroactive, so it shuts down all records that were previously requested, that it has this emergency clause, so it goes into effect immediately, and there's no ability for the public to referendum it, and that there's no judicial review, and if you request records from the legislature and they decide that you were doing so in a harassing fashion, they can deny you on those terms. So those are some of the many reasons why there is opposition to this. So process as well as substance.
Okay, that's one argument. The supermajorities in the legislature, they disagreed. This bill has passed. It's on the governor's desk. He's got till midnight tomorrow. Austin Jenkins, what's going to happen?
Well, what dollar amount should we put on this? It's I guess what I'll say is it's the 600 calls just this morning question that's kind of, you know. But what's so interesting about this, just to step back for a second, Bill, is I often say that covering the legislative beat, I feel like there is a disconnect between what happens down here and the 7 million Washingtonians out there. This issue seems to have awakened a sleeping giant. The governor's office says that the phone calls and the emails it's getting are unprecedented. There was former state representative Lynn Kessler, who sits in the Sunshine Committee, told a story about her husband sitting in a bar in Spokane this week with a gun owner, a vegetarian, and I can't remember who else was in there. But she said, you know, from the vegetarian to the gun owner in Spokane, they were angry about this and talking about it. So the public is, and it also shows the power of newspapers, you know, 11, 12 newspapers putting this on the front page of their, or on the front pages of their papers. Obviously, this has awakened the public. So that's the kind of framework for the governor now having to make a decision. He's been out of town in D.C. making some national headlines. He's now back in town, and he has four options. He can veto this, straight out veto it. He can do a partial veto. He could take out, for instance, the emergency clause. He could take out the, you know, elements that he doesn't like or he thinks shouldn't be in there. He can not sign it and let it go into effect, or he can sign it into law. And we don't know what he'll do. And in fact, I'm not sure he knows yet what he's going to do.
Well, the governor
he has until 11:59 tomorrow night.
I noticed Governor Inslee said on MSNBC that he doesn't like the bill, but he can't veto it because lawmakers have a veto-proof majority. That doesn't sound right.
That's not right. He can veto it, and they can override the veto, assuming they have the votes, and it certainly looks like they do. But he does, technically, he can veto it, and he can technically partially veto it. He can technically let it go into law without a signature, and he can technically sign it into law. Those are the four options that he has at his disposal.
Final question, Austin Jenkins. This is important to journalists, but what is at stake for people who do not make their living covering the legislature? What's at stake?
You know, the State's Public Records Act was passed, I think, in 1974. So that's 43 years ago. And it is, if you read it, it is very strong in its language about the importance of transparency and the fact that the government and elected officials in the state are working in the service of the public. And that the public has a right to see what they're doing and for transparency to reign. So that is like really built into sort of into the fiber of our state. And this is a law that applies to everybody from the dog catcher on up to the state level officials. And so the legislature is now saying it is exempt from that act. That's what it's doing here. That is hugely significant. The other part of this that I think makes it, you know, so important and part of why the public is so engaged is that you've got a situation now where the legislature is not only exempting itself from a public record, from a voter approved law, but moving so quickly to write the rules for itself without public input. And I think that process right in the midst of litigation is also what makes it this significant to the public. And at the end of the day, what does the public care about? The public cares about the influence of special interests on this institution, especially because it's representative democracy and most people don't have time to be down here keeping an eye on things.
Wherever you are on this argument, those are the stakes for people who are not professional journalists. We've got Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins watching what happens next with Governor Jay Inslee, who's got until midnight tomorrow, 11:59 p.m., to decide veto, partial veto, sign the law, let it become law. It's fascinating. Austin, thanks for laying this out for us.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we're going to be right back with the question of how connected, how smart do you really want your home to be? Stay tuned. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. My next guest, Kashmir Hill, specializes in first-person journalism, which has led to some unusual experiments. She has lived exclusively on Bitcoin. She has spent a week communicating only in caps lock, an entire week of being emphatic. This time, her experiment was to transform her apartment into a smart home and then track all the data she was sharing to see whether her smart home would betray her. And now she's co-written a book about it called The House That Spied on Me. Kashmir Hill, welcome to KUOW.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It was just an article, though, not a whole book.
Not a whole book. Okay, an article. Thank you. What did you do to make a smart home?
So I basically bought a bunch of internet-connected devices for my house. We already had a smart TV and an Amazon Echo, the smart speaker, but I got an internet-connected toothbrush, a photo frame, lights, a coffee maker, connected my bed to the internet. If you can think of it, I connected it.
Yes, and there are a lot of appliances that can be web-enabled. Will you remind us what that's about? What do you mean by connecting stuff to the internet?
So when something's connected to the internet, it means that you can operate it from afar. It means oftentimes that you can operate it by talking to it. So, you know, I can say, Alexa, turn on the lights, or Alexa, brew me coffee.
There are lights and coffee firing up right now across the region.
Yeah, actually, I know. I just muted the dot that's right next to me.
Right.
But sometimes it gathers data. So my bed, for example, would give me sleep reports in the morning, telling me, you know, how many times I tossed and turned, and what my heart rate was through the night, and what my breathing rate was through the night, which is I discovered is really annoying when you've had a terrible night's sleep for your smart bed to, you know, send a notification to your phone the next day telling you you missed your sleep goal and got a failing score. I'm like, I know, I feel terrible today.
Yeah, I can feel how much I missed my sleep goal. That's why it matters. Yeah.
Thank you for the reminder.
Yes. Why, Kashmir?
Well, you know, the reason that I was doing it, I thought, oh, it might be kind of nice to live in a home of the future. But I was also curious, as more and more people are getting these devices into their homes, what it means for our privacy.
Yeah. And what did you find out that it means for your privacy when you do that?
Yeah. So my colleague built a special router for me that I connected all my devices to. And the router was monitoring their activity. And so it kept track of the data that they were sending out, kept track of every company that they talked to outside of the home. And so we did this for 2 months and we just wanted to see what would happen. And It was pretty surprising. I mean, my home, the digital emissions from my home were going out all the time. Even when we were away for a week, the home was still active. There wasn't an hour of silence in the whole 2 months.
What do you mean your home's not being silent? What's being transmitted?
Well, all my devices were talking, almost all of them were talking to the companies that made them almost every day. Some of them talked really frequently to the companies. So, for example, my Amazon Echo was contacting Amazon servers every 3 minutes, you know, whether we were using it or not, which was really surprising to me because I know that the Echo, you know, it's always listening, it's always ready, but it's not supposed to react to you unless you say the wake word Alexa. And so I assumed that it wasn't connecting to the internet, you know, unless I said Alexa. But in fact, it's checking all the time.
Well, it might be pinging Kashmir, but I mean,
it's pinging.
But what does that mean? What kind of information is it sending about you?
So it's pinging. It's saying like, hey, I'm still here. Do you have any software updates for me? And in some cases, it could be, you know, sending information back. We weren't decrypting any of the traffic that was being sent. So in a lot of cases, we couldn't tell what data was being sent. There was an exception to that with the television because I had a smart TV, and every time I watched Hulu, we discovered the Hulu traffic wasn't being encrypted. So my television was actually sending back what Hulu shows I was watching to Vizio. It was also sending it to a couple of data brokers called Nielsen and Scorecard Research, which like to kind of like keep track of what people watch. So we couldn't always tell what was being sent back, but all of the devices were in.
Who knows what you were watching on TV? So this Vizio, so a corporation and data brokers, meaning what do you think that matters to you? Someone is selling information to target you better with ads, or someone is finding out how lowbrow you are, Kashmir, or what?
Well, I don't think that I'm lowbrow.
Okay, or highbrow.
I don't know what my TV thinks. Uh-huh. I mean, it definitely was going to data brokers who use that information to profile people's watching activity. My smart TV is made by a company named Vizio, so they knew, you know, every time the television was turned on, even if I wasn't using the internet. So, you know, we stayed in on New Year's Eve and watched a DVD, and my colleague was able to tell that from the data because it was being sent back that the TV was on that night.
Kashmir Hill did not get invited to a party.
Oh, Kashmir Hill has a baby.
I understand.
She has a 1-year-old, and so she and her husband stayed in on New Year's Eve. But yeah, you know, we're revealed not to be big partiers.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and that is data about me and about our lifestyle that I think if we've learned anything about the last 20 years of internet activity, there are these big data brokers that are constantly gathering data that's available to them and trying to, you know, crunch it and get insights into our behaviors to affect, you know, how they try to target us with ads, but also, as we've seen in this last year, use it for political purposes, you know, try to convince us to vote certain ways. And when you have more and more data, you have a more accurate profile of somebody. And what I think we learned from our experiment is that the tracking that we've all gotten used to whenever we go online may move into our living rooms as we start adopting this technology.
You mentioned your baby. What information were you sharing about your innocent, unwitting child?
Well, my poor daughter was subject to probably the most surveillance in the household because we had an internet-connected baby monitor in her room. So, you know, video was being collected. It also measured the air quality of the room. She had a couple of internet-connected toys, a Hello Barbie and an app called Toy Mill. But the most revealing information about her was probably coming from the Amazon Echo, because it was revealing when she wakes up and goes to bed. Because you could see in the data basically when the Echo was used in the morning. One of the first things we do is usually request music for her. And then at nighttime, we play Alexa's ambient sounds app. And so you could see when she was going to bed by when we requested those sounds to play.
Corporations know when your baby is sleeping. It sounds ominous.
I mean, it all sounds innocuous, right? Like, I can tell you're skeptical that this data is valuable, but even data you don't think is going to matter. Okay, so I had a smart toothbrush, and we
were
laughing
about. What's a smart toothbrush?
So a smart toothbrush connects to the internet. It, you know, sends you reminders to brush. It tells you how to brush. There's an app you can run while you're brushing. And we joked in our piece that, you know, one day a dental insurance company, you know, might have you use a smart toothbrush and then give you discounts on your premium.
Mm.
And we thought that sounded hilarious. In fact, it already exists and has been around since 2015.
I absolutely believe that. Sure.
It's a company called Beam. My smart vacuum, the Roomba, from a company called iRobot. You might think, okay, what, you know, how is a robot vacuum going to have valuable data? But in fact, iRobot CEO talked about how the vacuums map the home and how those maps could be really valuable to other companies in a smart home space, and that they hope to, you know, get a deal with Apple, Amazon, or Google in the next few years to share that map of the home with them, so that they know, you know, how furniture, what furniture is in the house and how it's arranged, and that that could be useful to know the acoustics of the room for their smart speakers.
That I was wondering where you were going with that. So the Roomba, we have one of those, and I know it pings around the room. It's got to know where the walls are and where the doorways are, kind of. I mean, it has. I can imagine it making a map, but who wants that map? It has to do with somebody caring about the acoustics in my house. I mean, it just seems like this is a floor level, quote unquote, map of what it's bumping into. But why is that a big deal?
Well, when you have Roombas in hundreds of thousands of homes that are bumping into the same furniture every single day, your Roomba, and you have to have the newest series actually to get a map. It's the 900 series, so you may or may not have that version of the vacuum.
I don't think I do. I don't know whether I should want that.
Yeah, I mean, it knows how, you know, it knows if you have a couch, how big your couch is. It knows whether or not
Wait a minute. Does it know my couch is? Like, is it sending signals upward? I just assumed the Roomba was only staring at my floorboards and out to the side because it was not up in the
air. I don't know about your Roomba. Your Roomba might not be as good as my Roomba, but my Roomba slows down when it is approaching an object. It slows down when it's approaching a person. You may have no idea what sensors are on your Roomba.
True.
And it's collecting data about you. And if it's internet connected, it's maybe sending it back to the company. And it's something you don't even think about, which I think was the important thing about this story, is just thinking about the sensors that you're bringing into your home with these objects that have never had the ability to spy on you before.
Kashmir, I've told, by the again, Kashmir Hill has written a piece about her experiment called The House That Spied on Me. I have mentioned in a little promo I did telling people what was coming up on the show, I mentioned I ticked off some of the appliances that you hooked up, and I'm going to let you judge how much you want to tell us about the fact that there's such thing as an internet-connected sex toy, but it's part of my larger question, which is about how your husband felt about your experiment.
So I did not use the internet-connected sex toy for its intended purpose, maybe in part because I knew my colleague was going to be looking at all the data that was being sent out by my devices.
Right.
And we actually didn't see that. You know, I did use it to see what data it sent, and we didn't see it doing anything problematic. Though I did report on a sex toy in 2016 made by a Canadian company called WeVibe that was sending all the data about its use back to the company, including when it was turned on, how long it was on for, the temperature of the device, and what settings were being used. And it was sending it all back every time it got used. Mm-hmm. And I asked the company about it, and they said, well, it's really valuable for market research. So
yeah, I would think.
The problem was the customers didn't realize that their orgasms were being data mined. Uh-huh. So they did sue the company, and there was a class action settlement last year for, I believe, more than $2 million. But yeah, my husband in general wasn't a big fan of the experiment, and it wasn't so much about the privacy issues. It was that, well, he didn't like a camera being pointed at him, and he did unplug it when I went out of town, but he just was annoyed by the smart home. Like, it just didn't work that well.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Now you have a home that's, something's going to be buggy about it, right?
Yes, there are definitely bugs in the home. The most annoying one was the coffee maker didn't get along as well with Alexa as we would have liked. So every morning we woke up and we would say, Alexa, make us coffee. And she would say, I don't understand. And there was a specific prompt we had to do, like Alexa, ask the Beemore to make us coffee or to run quick start. And so every morning, two caffeine deprived people begged Alexa to make coffee, and she would only kind of do it a third of the time. And my husband would say, oh, can I please just walk to the kitchen and, you know, turn on the coffee maker? And I'd be like, no, we have to do it the smart way. And so
yeah.
He was not very happy with me for the 2 months that we were running this experiment.
Well, that's a very 2018 reason to not have a smart home. It's just not worked out well enough yet. But
yeah,
overall,
the technology is still early stage.
Yes, but accounting for that, Kashmir, the takeaway here is there's the convenience or inconvenience of a smart home, and there are the privacy data sharing issues. And overall, what was your takeaway about your trying it out?
Yeah, I mean, my takeaway is that the smart home's not quite there yet. Like, a lot of the products don't work that well, but there are things I love. Like, I love the Roomba. I actually really like the coffee maker. I just don't like using Alexa to turn her on. I'd rather use the app. I think most of us are living in smart homes already. I mean, you can't buy a television that doesn't connect to the internet. Mm-hmm. One in six people, according to an NPR survey, has a smart speaker now. So my big takeaway was that everybody needs the router that my colleague built for me. They need a way to monitor the data that's going out of their home in the same way that, you know, most of us use some kind of extension on our web browsers now, so we can see who's tracking us and block certain requests. Or with your smartphone, you can, there's permissions for apps, so you can determine what information they get access to. Like, I kind of feel like we need that for our home routers now, so that we can decide what our devices are sending out about us.
Right. I wonder whether corporations would ever make that deal with us. I'll show you my information if you show me yours.
Yeah. that's a good way to put it.
We'll watch on that. Kashmir Hill is the co-author of a Gizmodo piece called The House That Spied on Me. And I'm glad to hear that you ended up having a good experience with your coffee maker anyway. There's that. And the Roomba's working out for you. And thanks for warning us about the downsides, Kashmir Hill. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Long before the smart speaker and Twitter and the Roomba, 15 years ago, I lived in Belltown, near the Sit and Spin, near the old Crocodile, which is in the same space as the new Crocodile, but it sure looks different. And if you've lived here a while, you know it can feel like Seattle is in permanent reinvention. Well, KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, has brought us a book of poetry that examines Seattle's many reinventions by looking at one building on Capitol Hill. The book is called Timber Curtain. It's by Frances McHugh. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Bill.
What building does Frances use in her book?
The Literary Arts Center Hugo House. So in the mid-1990s, Frances co-founded Hugo House. It was in an old Victorian across from Cal Anderson Park on Capitol Hill. And Frances lived in the house with her husband and daughter during her tenure as Hugo House's director. And that building was torn down about 2 years ago.
Yes, I remember the old Hugo House. Before it was a literary arts center, it was a mortuary.
That's right. That's right. So clearly, Frances has a connection to that old Hugo House building. And she uses that connection to extrapolate to larger issues of change and loss in Seattle. You know, one of the things that I wanted to tell you makes this book different from most poetry collections, Bill, is that Frances manipulates the real estate of the page in a very particular way. She uses a process of redaction. So in some cases, you'll see a poem, and then on the next page or the facing page, a redacted version with parts all blacked out to create a new poem. So here's Frances about that.
It looks a little bit like seeing an FBI redacted document in a spy thriller. You know, there are these, you know, blacked out sections of the poems. And I think what I'm interested in is how erasure, or the act of subtracting from a poem, creates a new poem that's surprising and resonant. And I think of it really as a metaphor for the city itself, that we're erasing and taking away old buildings and parts of blocks and things we used to be familiar with, and it changes our sight lines. And so the poems, I think, disrupt your sight lines about language. And in a way, language is a stand-in for the city. And so throughout the book, poems are erased and reassembled and kind of reconstituted to form a new city.
It's a great idea. If you could see the book, she is literally changing the sight lines of her own poetry.
And I'll put some photographs of those poems on the website, Bill, so listeners can see that.
Good, good. Okay, so Elizabeth, she's taking, Frances McHugh's taking a Seattle bulldozer to her poetry, and you have an example we can listen to.
Sure. So here's Frances McHugh reading, "Maybe This Building Should Go," and we'll follow it with two redactions or erasures of that poem.
Maybe this building should go. What else to do when something is dying? You say, finally, let it. This city block now slated for teardown. It's not your childhood, not you, that building. Every sentimentalist for miles says, my heart is in that place, and no, don't make another thing go away. Don't erase and replace places we didn't know we loved. It's just this, an old Victorian with a plywood cube nailed on. As the white sign goes up, we see what's to come down, in city speak. Soon enough, someone tags the sign, indigenous-like, marks that might be Salish for don't take one more thing away. It's not memory that lasts, but the terrain, old land, claimed and staked and stolen, old. Conquest taunts the bulldozer, nose up, claws grasping, heading into it. Maybe this should go. What else to do when something is dying? You say finally, let it, your childhood, with a plywood cube nailed on. Marks that might be Salish for claimed and staked and stolen. This stolen.
This stolen. Those are the only two words left standing after the poet Frances McHugh has finished redacting her poem. So the poem started out being called Maybe This Building Should Go. Then it became Maybe This Should Go. And then it was just called This. Again, her poetry collection is called Timber Curtain. Elizabeth, how did Frances McHugh decide what to redact to create her shorter erasure poems?
Well, I was curious about that too. So I asked Frances what she hopes to communicate through that process of erasure. Here's what she said.
It's kind of the case of like why real estate is so emotional. And then when you start subtracting, you get back to the fact that something happened to you in a place and that's why you're attached to it. So some people say that we're attached to these old places because they're the places where we last felt cool. You know, they were the places where we last saw ourselves in a light that was like interesting and, you know, youthful. And so I think trying to dismantle all of the layers of projection onto real estate is similar to dismantling layers of sentimentality until you get a fresh look at something. The truth is, I mean, we've all lost homes and we've all lost people. And there are places we love that are always disappearing. And I think my sentimentality kind of was derailed when I really started to think about migration and people living right now in refugee camps between places. And those places are places that can't really become places to them because, you know, they're not feeling so great living there. So I began to look at Seattle as this kind of infrastructure where people are really sad about what's disappearing. But I mean, maybe we should all be called out and realize that a lot of people don't have that luxury at all.
Wow, Elizabeth, she's taking something on there because I know people, longtime Seattleites, who do feel that sentimentality. It sounds like Frances doesn't have much patience for that in the big picture.
Well, I think she wants us to look at deeper layers of loss. So at the very end of that poem where she says, it's not memory that lasts, but the terrain, old land, claimed and staked and stolen. There were lives here before there was a city called Seattle. And that's what ultimately she's reminding us of, I think, in this poem and in the book as a whole.
And you're one of these longtime Seattleites.
I am, more than half my life. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm a writer. Hugo House has been vastly important to me, hugely important. And by the way, I want to make sure and say, Hugo House is being rebuilt in the same place.
Yes.
You know, which is exactly why what Frances is doing here works with these poems in terms of Hugo House. Although obviously it works in a larger sense as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what I keep coming back to is that, yes, I also have these places that I, you know, that make me think about people I don't have in my life anymore. They either aren't on the planet anymore or we're just not in each other's lives anymore. But ultimately, I think the value for me of these poems and this book is the way it really asks me to think beyond my own lifespan or even the lifespan of this city.
That's KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
And you will, of course, find images. As Elizabeth said, she'll put some photos up of the redacted poetry. And you can hear more of Frances McHugh's Timber Curtain. Just go to KUOW.org. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW, telling you about the changing Seattle. Now, here is yet another reason for real estate speculators to buy here in the changing Seattle area. We're cheaper than Vancouver, and now British Columbia is making real estate even more expensive for outsiders. And here to tell you about this new package of taxes is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
So a tax on speculators, that's a dirty word if you're trying to afford a place to live, but how does that tax in BC define speculator?
Speculators, foreign buyers, people who own two pieces of property in British Columbia and don't live in BC, people who don't pay income taxes here, people who leave property vacant and don't rent it out, they all fall under the thing. The government's brought in five new taxes, all of which hit real estate one way or another, property taxes, speculation, and collectively supposed to bring in more than $500 million. The big goal here is to make housing more affordable. The big risk, of course, is that you could puncture a housing bubble and have a whole bunch of people who have mortgages right now who lose value in their property end up underwater. So this could be a fairly precarious exercise by the government. But they did promise, Bill, when they ran for office last year, to make housing more affordable. And this is the action plan to do it.
As you say, popping a bubble or anything in real estate or investing, there are buyers and there are sellers. So you're going to create winners, you're going to create losers. But the idea of these taxes on real estate buyers is more popular than unpopular among the people of BC?
It's still pretty controversial. I mean, I think people recognize there's not an awful lot of sympathy for people with $3 and $4 million value homes having to pay more taxes. And there isn't a lot of sympathy for people who are holding real estate here for speculation and don't even live and work here. So that side of it isn't a lot of sympathy. Some of the other stuff, there is a bit of sympathy. There's, people who've owned a recreational property for a long time. They may live in Alberta, but they're still Canadians, and now they're suddenly going to get whacked for taxes unless they rent the place out. Well, I mean, people have pointed out, Bill, that if you have a family recreational property that your family's been coming to in British Columbia for a long time, if you have to rent it out, what are you supposed to do? Kick the tenants out when your family wants to enjoy the place? So there may have to be some tweaking on some of these measures, but I think the real concern is that, and we don't know which it'll be, it may not go far enough and may not actually drop housing prices enough to make housing affordable. It may, because of attacking demand in the market, also reduce supply. Builders won't be building new buildings because they don't think they can make a big enough profit anymore. And, of course, the other possibility is, as we say, and it's happened, in some places in the United States, where the bubble doesn't just slowly deflate, it pops. And a bunch of people that have climbed into the market in the last couple of years with very big mortgages find themselves underwater. And as you know, nothing happens like in isolation in the housing market. Our national government is busy making tighter rules for getting mortgages, so they're harder to get, and interest rates are going up. You put all that in the mix, all you're getting from the government here is, we're going to monitor all this. We're going to watch it carefully. We're going to monitor it, and we may have to tweak it. This is going to be a fascinating file to watch. I think in a year or so, Bill, other governments in other places will be looking at what happened here and either saying, that's the way to go, or we're not going to try that.
Well, we're monitoring it here, Vaughn. There are a lot of real estate shoppers, especially from China, but elsewhere, who would like a home in the Pacific Northwest with a strong economy and a beautiful setting and clean air and good schools and gee, look what they're doing in Vancouver. Seattle looks nice. I want to ask you about one more thing, Vaughn. I saw over the weekend some photos of Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in India wearing what looked like traditional local Indian outfits. I thought he looked out of place, but he was out of place. He was on a diplomatic visit. Why is Trudeau getting so much guff about what he wore?
Wardrobe malfunction. Yeah. Actually, most of the heat he's taken have actually been in India, where he's been ridiculed for dressing in a way that people said would be over the top for a star of a Bollywood film. Gold braid, dressing his kids and his wife up in these outfits. There's been a lot of fun in the political cartoons here. Some of what he was wearing was understandable. The head covering, he went to a temple. You cover your head in a temple.
Mm-hmm.
But some of it is a feeling of either cultural appropriation or ridiculously over the top. One guy in India, one commentator in India said, an Indian man would dress that way only going to his own wedding. You wouldn't do it on a diplomatic visit. So Trudeau kind of toned it down toward the end of the trip. But, you know, in politics, when they start laughing at you, that's when you got a political problem. And on this one, people in both countries, Canada and India, have been laughing at Trudeau pretty hard.
Well, this happens here. You had Reagan in an English riding outfit, and that was no big deal. Bush in a silk tunic in Vietnam, Clinton in Indonesia, Obama in China. So there's some interesting...
Dukakis in a helmet, as I recall.
Dukakis in a helmet, yes. Now, and finally, we have another minute and a half, but the backdrop to this also was this person who got invited to some receptions for Trudeau in India.
Yeah, Trudeau's back, and he's answering questions in Parliament every day, and the issue is, how did you manage to get meeting twice and photo ops and on your list of people to meet with a convicted terrorist? So a guy from British Columbia who a generation ago was convicted of a violent attack on a visiting cabinet minister from India, and who was charged with beating a Vancouver lawyer who later became Premier of BC within an inch of his life, member of a recognized terrorist organization. He ends up on the guest list in India for Trudeau's visit, actually gets into a photo op with Trudeau's wife. How did this happen? And the Prime Minister has been really struggling to explain this. He's blamed one of his own members of Parliament for putting this guy on the list. But one of his security officials suggested it was all a trap by India to embarrass Canada and Trudeau, and that one isn't going over very well at all. So, you know, the wardrobe malfunction is funny. This isn't funny. How does a guy who has a terrorist record end up standing next to the Prime Minister's wife at a diplomatic function?
Justin Trudeau, probably happy to be back in Canada, looking forward to putting all this behind him. And that's Vaughn Palmer, who is a columnist with the Vancouver Sun. Always good to talk with you, Vaughn. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Finally, on the record, Seattle Mariner fans, they're either in Arizona for spring break or they're here waiting for an end to the snow and an end to the drought. The Mariners have the longest playoff drought in the majors. Maybe this will be the year, though. We still have our ace pitcher, Felix Hernandez, I think.
Here's the pitch. Swing and a line drive off of Felix's right arm. Oh, my goodness. The ball to the front side of the mound. Felix is hurt.
The good news, nothing is broken. The ball missed Felix's zillion-dollar elbow and hit his somewhat less valuable forearm. But it is a reminder that playing baseball is dangerous. It's not the kind of thing you would want the Seahawks star quarterback to do.
I had some good ones out of there, you know, so that was fun. They thought I'd been hitting for years.
That's Russell Wilson. He's not been hitting for years. He's been playing football for years for the Seahawks, but he's speaking there from baseball spring training. Yeah, he's playing second base. How much trouble would the Seahawks be in if Russell Wilson got hurt playing for the Mariners? Wait, he is playing for the Mariners, right?
It's definitely one of the coolest things I've ever done. You know, ever since I was a young kid, I always dreamed to be a Yankee. My favorite player was Derek Jeter.
Russell Wilson is a member of the New York Yankees. This week, he said he hopes the Yankees win another World Series. Ouch. That is yet another line drive off the Mariner funny bone.
His teammates won't give him any trouble about that.
Oh, no, of course not.
No, I'm sure not. Thank you for listening today to The Record on KUOW. This show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. I hope you will tune in again tomorrow. See you then.